Today, we're taking a global look at a question that matters deeply in Hawaii. How do we build communities where children and adults are truly prepared to be safe around water? My guest, Natalie Martin, has spent more than 3 decades working in aquatics, life-saving, drowning prevention, education, and advocacy with experience spanning more than 20 countries. Her work has taken her from the United States and the Bahamas and to communities around the world, giving her a unique perspective on what works, what doesn't, and why successful drowning prevention must go beyond simply teaching someone to swim. We'll talk about what water competency really means, the role of schools and families, how culture and community should shape water safety education, and how we turn decades of research into action. Mostly importantly, we'll ask what Hawaii can learn from the rest of the world as we work to make water safety part of how our children grow up here in Hawaii. Natalie, welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've done some like amazing work, and I'm really excited about it. So let's just dive right in, okay? Everybody probably asks you how your journey begins, and you can tell me, but what gap in the global drowning prevention space led you to create the Swim Global Project? Can we start there?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, really, like many of us in this space, I started off as a lifeguard many decades ago, and I was really involved in lifeguard competition, and just really loved the entire lifeguarding community. But I think as my career progressed and I didn't stay aligned in the aquatic space for a long time. I did manage, aquatic operations. I worked for parks and rec and university settings. But then, I kind of stepped out of that to go into different spaces that were non-aquatic. But what was really interesting and has been really interesting is that I've always had that aquatic space move along with me along my journey, my career that was not in aquatics. So, for example, lifeguard training, being involved in research, and just really being involved with the work as a volunteer, specifically, sitting on boards and sitting on different committees, looking at drowning from different lenses. So, that's been really interesting. And then moving to Florida over the last decade, I really started dedicating more and more of my work to drowning prevention. So I've been doing some work in humanitarian and in humanitarian aid. And then I was like, I'm still really drawn to the drowning issue because it is a public health crisis. Whether you're in the US, France, a country in Africa, we do all speak the same language. Of course, geographically and community looks very different, but the language is the same, which is really interesting. And so I quickly understood that the work was far more than just, pools, beaches, or even competition. I really understood throughout my career that drowning was about public health, it was about equity, education, and access. So, why I started the Swim Global Project was I started it 5 years ago in the height of in the height of the pandemic. But why I started the Swim Global Project was one, primarily because I had been involved in so many different sectors in this space. And I always felt that there was a missing link between the advocates, the practitioners, the researchers, in the work that they were doing. And I really wanted to create a network, is really how the idea started.
Well, that makes you refer to your organization as a bridge builder. What does that mean in practice, and who are you trying to connect? Just like you're just saying, which I think makes total sense. So if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the Swim Global Project, I look at this as a network that brings together people from different backgrounds that are doing work in drowning prevention, water safety education. So my network includes owners of swim schools, it includes public health, individuals in public health. It includes individuals who are doing research. It includes operators. And so there's such a wide range of individuals that may not have had the opportunity to expand their own community network for whatever reason. A lot of times we get so boggled down with the work because, there's so much to do that we don't realize that, hey, if I'm part of a network, not only am I going to be able to connect with new individuals, but also there's a sense of community that's being built around the Swim Global Project and just knowledge sharing.
Right.
We refer in aquatics to, the term is best practice. And I think that that's what I'm building with the Swim Global Project.
So you talk about prevention as being practical. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the guiding principle of the Swim Global Project is really that no one should face a barrier to entry when it comes to learning how to swim. And when I say practical, is that every community, of course, we all need access, to a location to learn to swim, whether that's a river, stream, lake, beach, or pool. So when I mean what I do mean about practical is that one, let's start where we're at. Let's not try to reinvent the wheel, and let's bring experts that can support the development of these water safety education initiatives or community activations. So really, again, the disparity of, funding, the disparity of access, equity, sometimes it's cultural, can cause some difficulty in creating those spaces. But if you step back and take a look at what already exists and find those experts, you keep it simple, right? Especially at first, if your community may not have all the equipment that is needed. Well, really, we can argue that we don't even need water, to get water safety education. So let's keep it
Right.
practical. Understanding what we have, what we can start with, is a really good starting point.
I totally agree. And a lot of countries have been successful with frameworks and pathways. And UK's the latest one to have it into the school system in 2026. It's a developed curriculum, developmental levels, and includes education w along with water competency. And I want to talk about that and what you've done and been successful in Florida. But before that, can we step back and tell me what you've done in the Bahamas and Bimini? And what did you see in disparity there? I'd like to hear about that.
Sure. We have not been back to the Bahamas just for different reasons. Like, building capacity building is really important for the Swim Global Project. But what we found in the Bahamas, Bimini, actually the Caribbean, is that about 90% of individuals don't know how to swim. There's the culture around going to the beach. There's a culture around obviously fear. There's some generational trauma, of course, around access to water. So what has caused this is just layers and layers and layers of historical, I'm almost gonna say misinformation about swimming. And so there's a level of fear that exists from generation and it's passed down to the next generation. So the biggest thing to learning how to swim first starts The biggest issue, it starts at home. It starts with the family. So if the family is fearful, then it's going to be very difficult to get young children or adults into the pool. One of the things why we went to the Bahamas was because we found local partners. And so what I will say, and perhaps it's going to segue into a different conversation, is that I've learned a lot through a lot of these projects. So not only have I been going to the Caribbean, had opportunities to go to South America, I've had opportunities to go even to different regions in North America to provide this level of swim education. And I think over the years, I've sort of re-educated myself. Maybe the pandemic forced me to look a little deeper at how we were practicing all this. And I found myself realizing that I did not want the Swim Global Project to be an organization that goes into a community for 2 weeks, brings experts, and then leaves. So I don't know if that really answers your question about Bimini, but that's sort of like where I'm sort of heading now. So in order to pick a location, for now moving forward, it really has to be led by the local organizations that exist. So with Bimini, what was great actually, of course, its proximity to Florida. Many people didn't even know that Bimini existed, right? It was also the local partners. So I'm talking Waterkeepers Bahamas, so organizations that are involved with the environment. I think if we want to create good swimmers, we also have to align it with good stewardship of our oceans and, environment. Anyway, so long story short here was that we really were careful in choosing local partners that could continue the long-term sustainability so that I didn't want to keep going. I mean, obviously, it's a beautiful location, but I really wanted local organizations to build locally and to build local expertise.
Well, that makes sense. And you talked about South America. Is there a success story there in anything you've done?
I think, we worked in the, well, we worked in Venezuela. So that situation has shifted, right? Because of everything politically that's happening there. And honestly, those communities are more focused in, finding ways to earn a living wage and dignified work. So when you talk about drowning prevention, they're like, nah, that's not even on our radar. But what was successful, again, was that we built programming. And at that point, I hadn't yet launched the Swim Global Project, but I had always, seen this as the next step. And what was great about, again, Venezuela was that it was a multi-agency, multi-sectoral approach to programming. So we did, we connected with a water safety symposium. We did, of course, swimming education and introducing different concepts of how to bring simple programs into communities. We did lifeguard training. So it was very much, again, multi-sectoral when we looked at that.
Well, that makes total sense. And so I want to go into what you've done in Florida because we can learn from that in Hawaii as we struggle to get legislation, we tr struggle to get things in the Department of Education. As you said, we can start where we are, but we should keep it simple. So if we don't have all these pools, that doesn't mean we don't do something, right? That we don't have to create more resources to do things. But I'm interested in knowing what you know about the WHO Protect that came out just in July of 2026, which is a framework that says everybody's got these wonderful water safety plans, but how do you put them into effect? And you've done this on Florida, but maybe you can give us an overview of that and then take us into what you've done in Florida, because we're struggling with that. We have a water safety coalition. And then we have committees, but we don't have anybody overseeing with some kind of power in the government to say, this needs to get done. And you're accountable to me getting it done. So, okay, Natalie, that's a lot to learn
Yes.
about.
Well, I will say it's not one single individual, right, that
Right.
tries to get this done. Of course, there's very strong will, especially over the last couple of years where our numbers are still not going down. And I will preface that by saying we know what we need to do. I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel. We're not, going at this completely blind. I think we know what we need to do. The research is there. As you said, there are coalitions. So in Florida, the relationship that has been built, so the Water Smart Florida Task Force, the relationship that has been built over the last couple of years has really strengthened. With the Florida Department of Health. And honestly, if you read the Global Strategy on Drowning Prevention, if you look at different, very high level research that comes out in drowning prevention, public health departments really need to be part of the conversation. And so I think that's a strength of Florida is our connection, arm's length, to the Florida Department of Health. Not only at a state level, but now at a county level. And I also think that our data collection is incredibly strong. We have organizations and individuals where that is their sole job is to evaluate drowning deaths, evaluate fatal and non-fatal drowning statistics. So that has really helped to kind of govern implementation, and not only implementation, but measurement. How do we measure our success?
I have to stop you there because we're having trouble with that, and our Department of Health didn't have any epidemiologists. Now we do, and now the CDC Foundation has come in to help us. And you may be familiar with Watchtower, but our lifeguards are starting to use that digital way of taking charge.
Good.
Okay, but that's very new, and then the CDC is supposed to help that. So we're really in the beginning stages. Because the non-fatal drowning statistics are really where it's at, and we don't have that kind of data. So you're telling me who's doing it in Florida? Tell me your group that's so active in research collection.
I mean, there's different organizations in Florida. So in 2014, actually, there was legislation, and I think legislation is also one of the key underliers to change these numbers. We know that if there's no legislation that exists at all, it's going to be very difficult to change the numbers. And that, I think, that's an underlier.
What do
So
you think the
if
number one piece of legislation you should have, that the bottom line piece?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's what I was going to say. In
Okay.
2014, there was legislation that came out of Florida that really dictated to the Florida Department of Health that they needed data collection. They needed to be able to survey that no those numbers. They needed a system that could identify any kind of injury or any kind of information. So we're not just talking drowning prevention, right? We're talking if you need to know how many residents live in a county, what is their age, what is their demographic, what are the top injuries, what is their income, like that has been developed in a way that now we have those staff and those teams of people at the Florida Department of Health that is again their job. They're the specialist in that type of data. And that was because of legislation, and I can certainly send this to you by email, the link. That's
Okay.
because of legislation that came out in 2014. So what is the most important legislation? Oh my goodness. I mean, that's so hard to,
It's hard.
answer. I mean, I think the 2014
Yeah.
legislation was really a good step in the right direction. And you know, there's a lot of bad news that comes out of Florida, but when it comes to the governance around the data, the governance around the Florida Departments of Health, so not only from a statewide, but the fact that we have county departments of health,
Right.
I think, yeah, I it's a very sophisticated, it's pretty sophisticated. And I'm really, you know, I feel grateful that I'm able to work, you know, alongside some really, really great people.
So tell me what you've done now in Florida. I mean, you said our drowning rates have not come down.
No.
Are you specifically talking about Florida?
Yeah.
Okay, and we don't have the current data, but we have incidents every day, pretty much, and people go, well, that's just another issue, and we don't know all the non-fatal ones. We don't have any information, and the response is it's hard to collect that data.
Yeah.
How do you respond
Yeah.
to something like that? And tell me how you've worked on that in Florida. So.
Yes, so we have the WaterSmart Florida Task Force, and this task force right now has about 150 individuals from different organizations where, you know, we have really helped to create the action plan that was led by two individuals that work for DCF. And so they steered that work. It took a couple years. And so now we finally have our action plan. And so in Florida, you know, we continue seeing very high numbers with backyard pool incidents. The data is collected, and I don't want to misquote, but I mean, the data is collected differently based on organizations, but we typically go and get our data. Obviously, from the state public health department, we get it from DCF, and there's one other organization that we try to get it from. You know, when it comes to hospitalization, and so the DCF data that comes out, it's pretty instant because the DCF data, really, it's the Department of Children's and Families. They get notified when there has been a fatal drowning, and they get notified when they think that, maybe there was neglect, so there needs to be further investigation. Which means, though, on the flip side, we don't capture all the data of children drowning because not all of those drownings, or teens drowning, not all of those drownings get reported because, you know, it's a different circumstance. But it's good, you know, the two organizations end up working very closely together. The data that comes out of the Florida Department of Health, it takes a little longer to disseminate the information because they need to be very diligent on, you know, how it's reported, how is the hospitalization recorded, you know,
Right.
do they go in as a non-fatal drowning? And then they ended up having a heart attack. So now that victim, that patient, gets coded as a heart attack instead of, you know, the initial reason they went to the hospital.
Yep, that seems to be the issues we have here too with collecting
Yeah.
data. So I don't know what we're supposed to do with that, whether this watchtower, do you use watchtower in Florida? Do the lifeguards use that app?
I believe a few of the USLA, the United States Lifesaving Association, I think some of those agencies, the beach agencies, do use Watchtower. And I think that's where there needs to be more refinement, there needs to be more buy-in, because we just don't know, right,
Right.
on the beach side, on the ocean side, what that data really truly looks like.
Well, we've gotten some legislation here, which is
Okay.
fencing and drainage issues. That became a law last year, but that's just the tip of the spear, really. And there's no overall state priority for water safety. And so then, if there's not, then, as you said, it becomes harder to implement things. So you're saying you have a task force. What's the difference between a task force and a coalition?
Well, in our minds, the task force really does not it's not only about meeting and going through presentations. The task force in our minds is that they get work done. So they go back to their organizations. For example, if we're, tapping them with some data collection information and doing some comparisons, they understand that they will be tasked, with some of those priorities. That's in our mind in Florida. I mean, coalition, I don't think coalition is a bad word either. I think we really wanted to focus on this is a working task force. There are subcommittees within those ta that task force, like data and surveillance, like policy. We have a communication working group. So there's different working groups that also produce some of the stuff that we need to set out. And so for us right now, the added positive is that the state of Florida, the government administration, they have supported a swim lesson voucher. And they tasked the counties, so the Florida Department county agencies, with monitoring the vouchers, delivering the vouchers, and really trying to connect a system where it was governed and managed by the departments of health. So I think that really helped also over the last couple of years to increase sort of that piece of, okay, we have a swim voucher program. We need to deliver, right, to the right communities. People need to, families need to sign up, vendors need to sign up, and it's a really big task for the Florida Department of Health, but it's really helped the task force to be viewed as an operational task force and perhaps less governance type.
How does the money, how are you supporting that with a voucher? Obviously, that's free equity swim lesson. Is the Department of Education involved in this?
No, the Department of Education is not directly involved. This is coming from the state administration. So they've dedicated now another $1.5 million towards this program. Children under the age of 5 are, of course, a priority. Children with autism are a priority. So for the voucher, you apply online, you need to meet the criteria. So there's a threshold there. But yes, so it's the government that is supporting this.
Okay, so you're getting measurable outcomes from this? Are there metrics that are from
Oh,
this benefit
yes,
program? Okay, good.
absolutely. Yep, we're starting to get some metrics. The voucher program started 2 years ago, so we're now kind of, getting some metrics, not only on the numbers of, families that are using it, but metrics on how many vendors out there are offering, how do they apply? And it was interesting, I had a meeting yesterday in Central Florida, and they were saying in one region, they only have 2 vendors, so they're beyond at capacity. So that's a measurement that is really important to us. So yeah.
Yeah, I think it'd be also interesting how the kids and families respond to it. Before, afterwards, 3 months later, I know that's research that I think is really needed.
It
Sam
is.
Johnson, who came on for the framework and pathway for the UK, talked about some research he wanted to do, which was people's experience with water. Did they have a bad experience? And anecdotally, I've heard from lots of people saying they've had a bad experience when they were young in the ocean or a pool. So that was
Yes.
very, very interesting. So let's get back to this framework and pathway idea, because if we're talking here about water safety education in school, how do you see that? I mean, we can talk about swimming, and I think swimming's important. It's an important piece. But we used to have water safety in our schools, and it isn't anymore. The push here is to get education into it, somewhat like Australia or New Zealand or what UK has done, the developmental framework, starting very young, educating them, because the assumption is if that is in the classroom, they go home and talk about it. Then the family's involved with it, then it becomes a community thing. The assumption being, if we didn't have math in school, math wouldn't be considered important, would it? But if water safety, especially in an island community like Hawaii, becomes very central. And I know you have a water safety plan that you were part of working on the United States water safety plan, correct? Yeah. And so now Hawaii has it. And so we're working really hard, but the Department of Education, feels probably pretty overwhelmed because of resources. So if you talk about that, where do you see that plays a role in water safety? And we talk about water safety, we talk about water competency. What is the difference there? And then with all the swim schools, should there be a standard of how people should teach swim lessons? Should there be a framework? Because we have lots of people teaching different things, right? We have the YMCA, the Red Cross, and then we have lots of different groups, and they all have their way. Should there be a national standard for what should be taught? I'm not a swim person, but what is the difference between water safety education and water competency? Can you explain that? Okay.
So water safety education, like I mentioned, can be taught in a classroom. You don't necessarily need a pool, to offer water safety education. Water safety education is really advocacy. It's about collaborating with different organizations to get the information out, and really knowledge sharing and information sharing is key when it comes to water safety education. So that's how I kind of see the difference between water safety and then water competency. Yes, the water competency piece. At the Swim Global Project, for example, or even the task force, we don't take a stance on what skills need to be taught. Where we do take a stance is that we want children to be able to swim back to the side if they fall in the deep end. We want children to be able to wear a life jacket in a pool. I know that's very controversial, but we want children to wear those Coast Guarded approved life jackets in the pool. Of course, when you're boating, these are all pieces that come up when we talk about water safety education. And so, water competency really is, in our framework, making sure that a Floridian, if they fall in, deep water, they're able to get themselves to safety. What skills are used? We don't take a stance because, yes, I mean, there are safer practices, with the instructor entering the water, instructor really making sure that they're providing ongoing feedback, that the instructor is making sure that there's, that they're staying safe with the child around and in the water. And then I know there was another part of the question, but I don't remember.
Well, I think the life jacket's a good one because there's lots of incidents where kids think they're competent in the water by having some kind of floaty, and then they just jump in the water thinking they're okay. The life jacket's a very important piece, and a U.S. Coast Guard, right, a life jacket is very important. I paddle for an outrigger club here, and sometimes we have young kids that want to come because we're doing something. So we have to have fitted life jackets, and it isn't like you just throw a life jacket on somebody. And not all life jackets are meant for the sport, right? Or where you are. So I think the life jacket's a very important piece. And I think if kids know they can't go near the water unless they have their life jacket on, that might really decrease the amount of drownings in pools. I mean, that to me seems like a very preventative, practical piece, as you've said, your whole project's about. So I'm all for that.
Yeah, exactly. We know in Florida, we have, of course, experience with talking to the parents who have lost a child to drowning. Oftentimes, it's when they went boating or backyard pool. And during the swim time, that child was wearing a life jacket. And then during non-swim times, unfortunately, the child goes back into the pool. Somehow gets access and ends up in a terrible situation. So the life jacket is an important component when we look at layers of protection. We definitely try to educate and get the information out that arm floaties is not okay. Anything that you have to inflate is not a good option. So I would say I have never known a child to drown in a pool in Florida because they were wearing a life jacket. Now, there are lots of circumstances that can come up, and this one I think came up, I think it was New Jersey. I don't want to be quoted on it. It could have been Florida because I do see so much news. That a boat had struck another boat, and the boat that was struck flipped, and two girls wearing life jackets were unable to be rescued in that situation. So that's a very, very specific underlying issue that just because you are wearing a life jacket, just because you have a barrier, just because you have an alarm, it doesn't mean you can leave your children alone, right? And I think supervision still is the number one key of layer of protection that will keep your child safe. It's really about supervision. Get in the water, stay within arm's reach, and rotate with someone else if you can, but you need to be watching your children.
When we talk about layers of protection, we can talk about behavior because we're saying all these messages and we're not changing much behavior. But I think your organization makes a lot of sense and you have a lot of key recommendations. And I just wonder why those recommendations can't be put to every swim school, a standard that they have to cover these areas. They have to give parents and kids this information. And it needs to come in different areas. It should be in the schools. It should be in the swim lesson, right? It should be so many, because you have to keep repeating the message until people get it. And you can't just do it in one place. And so when I look at swim lessons and I'm on a water safety committee, a lot of people and people are saying, what are your metrics? Nobody really has any metrics. They can say how many people went. Maybe they learned to get in and out of the pool, but what else are you measuring, and what have you actually said to them about prevention? I think all those things are important. We have a snorkeling issue here, where people drown from snorkeling, and we all know from research, and we should talk about this because you said we've got great research. How do we make it so people get to understand it at a common level, right? But the research shows that their breathing apparatuses, they're not like a toy. So 90% of the snorkeling incidents come with visitors. So we have tried to talk about how we do the messaging. And what was brought up in a meeting and maybe one of the interviews I've done is we should know exactly what the tour boats are saying. Everybody should be saying the same thing. Right? They should all be giving the same information because if we don't do that, we have no idea what's being said. Maybe they're not saying anything at all. They may say, some do, we're not taking any full face masks, even though we sell them at Costco here. Right?
I know.
So it's all that. And I think if we have an overall approach, that's where I go back to a framework and a pathway that I think everybody needs to have a big overall picture of what we expect, right, for prevention, that it's a global issue, like you said. So you've been all over the world, and you have said, We have this marvelous research, I know, the International Drowning Research Alliance, which is spectacular. I've had David Spielman, I've had Justin Semstrat, I've had Mike Tipton, I've had, all these people who have done research all over the world, wonderful research, but it's not out to general organizations. How do we, I mean, you've talked about this, how do we get that to a level where we're giving that message to people so they can take action with evidence-based research?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's such a good question. I mean, the gap exists, right? It's such a big gap. I think it's getting closer, as we expand how we think about drowning. So the gap has closed a little bit, but yes, absolutely right. I mean, the research kind of sits in one bucket, and then operationally, how it's implemented sits in another bucket. And I think with the Swim Global Project, what I've been able to do, because I kind of wanted to see where my organization would fit in. I didn't want the organization to be the same as really what currently exists. And so where I come in is, again, creating that network of connecting. I'm very well informed. The individuals you just mentioned, I know them all, and we've worked really well together. Just even online as part of conversations. So the network needs to help support the development of actions. So typically, when you look at a research paper, obviously sometimes you read it and you're like, oh my gosh, what did I just read? It's so high level. But you should read it from a lens of what can I do to improve my community based on the research I know? And I don't think we're asking that question enough still. I
Yes.
think there's such a disconnect, right, between the research and the operators. And sometimes the recommendations that the research are doing in an ideal world, I love blue sky thinkers, in an ideal world, we would be able to, bridge that gap and operators be like, absolutely, this is great. I am, based on the research, we need 17 lifeguards on our pool deck, but realistically, I can only afford five,
Right.
and that's the minimum. So I'm only gonna have five. So yeah, again, so complex. It's so complex.
Well, it's just like going to conferences. People go to conferences, they get all excited, and they come away, and nothing happens. And so there's got to be a way that you take these World Drowning Conferences, somebody takes that research and makes it readable as actionable items that people can look at. That is a project that would be really worthwhile. An
Yes.
example here that on the show, there was a Dr. Angel Yanagihara. I had no idea who she was, but she came on the show. She's a world expert in jellies. She has come up with a protocol called Sting No More. She came on the show and she said, I'd like to say something. Can I say something about the Honolulu Ocean Safety Bureau? I said, sure. She goes, they're using the wrong protocol. Now, I don't know how much you know about Hawaii, but in Waikiki by the aquarium, we have a consistent jelly problem. And so the signs go up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so she says they're using the wrong protocol. So I explored that because what was happening was the Honolulu Ocean Safety Bureau is its now standalone piece. They're much more agile. They can make more decisions. They're not under the fire department or EMS or anything else. So they're standalone. And so they have a new medical director. Long and the short is, he went and looked at her lab and goes, wow, I didn't even know this existed. Right? And they're now going to use it as a protocol. Yet they knew about it, sort of, kind of. She's world class. And was responsible for Diane Nyad when she did her swim for being a consult. They made her go on that whole trip. So, and she's doing a sabbatical now in Harvard because of her research and everything she's done. But that's an example of major research right here in our backyard in Hawaii that nobody was really aware of, right?
Yeah, I
They
know.
just, yeah. So, more of that, I think.
Well, and that's where the Swim Global Project comes in.
Right.
I have publicly said this, more and more, I guess, as I reflect deeper into this work and what the Swim Global Project really truly means, I would love to go to all the conferences and attend, and the networking is really important. But for me, these conferences, are already a barrier to entry because the individuals that need to attend these conferences for a plethora of reasons just don't have the ability to get there. Most of the time it's a financial ability. And what kind of frustrates me is that the conversations that are happening at these conferences, it's often the same individuals. I think that we are seeing also a shift. And so at the last World Conference, I had a couple of my ambassadors that were able to attend. I have a group of advisors that give some time to the Swim Global Project. And I said, yeah, we need to share what was shared at the conference because most people weren't there. And so I did a post-conference webinar with some very specific questions on, what did you guys learn? What were some of the trends? What surprised you? And the feedback I received from that online webinar was so positive.
Yeah.
And you feel included in the pursuit of developing drowning prevention, whether it's community programmings or policies.
Yeah, ownership. Ownership
Ownership.
is really important for people to make change, right? And I think this is the more I talk to you, Natalie, there another piece of you have like something like 45 ambassadors or something. Tell me about that. I mean, it's a little off what we're talking about, but you have 45 ambassadors working with Swim Global Project. What is that?
So my priority is working with Florida in creating, different action plans and implementation and actually supporting different legislation. So that's my focus, from that lens. The other lens is these ambassadors. I'm moving into my third cohort, actually, for recruitment until the end of August. This third cohort will also be focused on being mentored by me, and also helping them kind of see that their work is not this little, drop in the sea, that they're part of a larger community. And so the ambassador program for me is going to evolve. I truly believe it's going to evolve based on the people who are successful in, taking on that role. The ambassador program, I started it 3 years ago. Again, I'm a bit of an entrepreneur. Well, I am an entrepreneur. So I was like, if I try to make this program perfect, I'm going to be another year before I don't launch it. And I already had in my head
Yeah.
how I wanted the cycle to go. So my ambassadors, again, very community-led programs that are being led by them. So that's really important. And then we work towards World Drowning Prevention Day. So when the new cohort starts, they'll join the other two cohorts. And the goal is that we work towards World Drowning Prevention Day. But also, I help them to kind of shift this mindset, especially, in the global south, developing world. Oftentimes, they'll see someone like me who, they're like, well, I need money, I need, funding for this program. And as much as I would be able to say, yes, let's fund all these programs, I think what's really important is for them to understand that a lot of time their local government can really help them. And I help them kind of recognize that. I help them with their mindset shift. And I always ask them, as part of that intentional question, what is the action that you want to change in your community? That answer might be different in a year from now, but what is it right now that you want to change in your community? What is the action for change? So that's sort of the role of the ambassadors. These are volunteer roles. We meet once a month. We have a WhatsApp group. Like I always say, you get what you put in, and that's okay. Some ambassadors may not have the capacity to consistently communicate.
How do you do that with time differences?
I know, right? Oh, I think I'm finding the magic number. I think,
It's midnight for you.
I know, I know. I think I found the magic number at 9 a.m. It's once a month, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So I think the magic number. I mean, that would be very early for Hawaii, but if someone, really wants to do it, they will.
Right.
So yeah, I found the magic number there. And really the ambassadors, they just feel like they're supported. They're supported in the work that they're doing. If they have questions or, something's not going quite right, they know that they can either reach out to me or perhaps another ambassador, right? I
Right.
want them to share knowledge. I want them to share what they're doing. And I always say this, I mean, there's space for everyone,
Right.
in this work.
I think that's a really good model, Natalie. And so
Well, thank
I think you should expand it so that these people, let's say you have somebody in Venezuela, maybe,
Yeah.
and then you have somebody, have you done anything in Europe at all? Not in Europe.
Yes. The UK and Denmark.
Okay. And so you get those people, and then maybe quarterly they put up whatever the progress they've had, right?
Yes.
And then maybe you include in that any current research. Like there's Laura Trapani, who's this young ER doctor in Italy, who did some research and found out that these kids were almost dying, some did, from wearing full face masks. And so she came up with this piece of framework that Justin Semstrop brought up to the IDRA group, that the full face mask said something about age when it really should say something about weight. And so I'm not going to talk about all the physiological because I'm not the doctor, but she did that. And
Oh,
the
interesting.
ministry in Italy is now putting together something to talk to the manufacturers of full face masks that they want things changed.
That's excellent.
Yes, those kinds of things might be good for everybody to know about, right? And then a woman in South Africa said, we have enough research. The onus is on the manufacturers of snorkeling gear and full face masks to actually test them for safety.
Exactly. And so, this with the Swim Global Project, and I'm part of that IDRA group as well, I try to, showcase or share some of the research that exists, and I disseminate it in a way that, the ambassadors can easily go, oh, okay, that makes sense, right? If there's a call to action
Yeah.
somehow in the research. Yeah, I mean, there's so many pillars that
There are pillars.
we can talk about. I go ahead.
No. I think you just got to keep doing it, right?
Yeah.
Because then it evolves into something bigger.
Exactly.
And I think of just the coalition group here, they don't have access to information. It'd be nice that they could go, oh, I could go to Swim Global Project and find the research, the current research that may help us, right?
Yeah.
Like frameworks and pathways. I mean,
Exactly.
those are amazing what people have done. Do you
Oh, yeah.
see the advantage of having one? Because I do.
Oh, for sure. So right now, I sit with the AOAP, the AOAP, the Association of Aquatic Professionals, and I launched their research committee. So I launched that last year. And now that committee is, looking at what are the priorities for the first year, where are some of the gaps, what currently exists. And there is a library that we have through AOAP. So, you know, I'm trying to maybe keep that, you know, under AOAP, but I can also refer back to, you know, my ambassadors and advisors to say, this is the research, you know, that we have on these full face masks, for example.
Right.
It's, you know, it can be really interesting for some of the ambassadors to go and say, oh, I'm definitely going to put a note about that in my facility as a standard.
Right. I think it's important to everybody see that, because we get very insular here in Hawaii. And people want to share things, but they don't have time.
I know.
So I think as Allison Schaffers has said, who wrote the Water Safety Plan, is also a journalist, we may not have made as much progress legislation this time around, but there's much more conversation about drowning,
yes,
and drowning prevention, right? So I want to move into something. You're part of USLA. You went to the Nationals. You've been a lifeguard. We got lifeguards as a resolution as first responders. Now I just saw in the news that there's a national push, a federal push, to make ocean lifeguards first responders.
Yep.
So tell me about, you were at the USLA. We couldn't meet because of that. And last week I had to go to an appreciation for lifeguards, and it's still here, Lifeguard Appreciation Week.
Yes.
And we have Duke's Ocean Fest coming up, because Duke
That's
Kahanamoku
right. Yeah.
is a wonderful person. And I was told one of the most interesting events, this is getting off a little bit, is surf polo, something that Duke used to play.
Okay.
Okay,
Well, it's so creative what can come out of the water.
So tell me about USLA Nationals and what your role was there.
Yeah, I mean, the competition is a national championship that brings lifeguards from around the country together. There actually were a few athletes that came down from Canada, so that's always nice to see. The championship this year, I think, was the largest they ever had. They had over 1,200 competitors, which is phenomenal.
Wow.
And I always say, and I think the ILS, the International Life Saving Association, states this, that life-saving sport is the only sport with a humanitarian mission. So a lot of the skills, sometimes people are like, well, you know, how is, you know, I don't know, paddling with a surf ski going to, you know, make a good lifeguard? And what I say is that the skills are all related to some kind of rescue, whether you're in the pool or the ocean, they are related. You may not throw, I don't know, a line, you know, to someone who is drowning, but at least you get to practice what that looks like. And so with USLA, they are the, you know, leading agency in beach lifeguarding. And I'm always surprised to learn that not all beaches are USLA certified. So that's always really interesting.
What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, a USLA agency goes through, you know, the minimum standard that has been set out by USLA, and usually an agency that's approved just kind of falls under the umbrella with other agencies. So it gives them a little bit more legibility. It gives them, you know, access perhaps to other types of training. And really it's about accountability to the public. And so I think when you say that your beach is, you know, certified or approved, it's an approved agency, it gives you a credibility that you're not only working within your own organization on the beach, but that you're reporting what you're doing and how you're training your team back to the USLA, who really, you know, play kind of a governance piece. But
interesting. So there are a lot of places on the mainland that aren't USLA certified?
There are a few. Yeah. I mean, I can't give you the exact number, but there are a few that are not agency.
Okay. So where does Hawaii fit in that? But we're not part of that. Is that what you're saying?
Hawaii, I thought Hawaii was USLA certified.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You guys hosted the USLA meeting last year, I believe, or the year before, right? So, yes, I think Hawaii is a great example of all aspects of water safety with the public as well.
And so what did you do at the Nationals this year?
Yeah, so I've been an official for life-saving sport for years. I was an official. They give you different roles, and I really enjoy that aspect of lifeguarding because it allows you to, sort of see, wow, there's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of people training in life-saving sport. But also we get to see the juniors because the juniors typically happen right before what we call age group and open. And so seeing these junior kids like battle out waves and use of their equipment, swimming a good distance, it's like, okay, it's quite inspiring.
Well, everybody says who's been a lifeguard, you're a lifeguard for life, right?
Exactly. Yes, 100%. Once a lifeguard, always a lifeguard. Yep.
Well, I hope so. Getting back to the resolution and lifeguards
Yes.
as first responders, do you think we're going to get that through? Do you think there's momentum? I do.
Yeah, I really do think there's good momentum. I mean, we all saw the rescue that happened in Santa Cruz. I mean, that was, it's great that it went viral. Ryan was such a great example for what ocean lifeguards do. I also warn people that this is not an isolated incident. Like, these types of rescues happen every single day in, ocean US beaches. Like, this is just not an incident, isolated. And then I'm often asked, well, what do you think, like, between ocean lifeguards and pool lifeguards? Why aren't pool lifeguards also being pushed to be as acting as first responders? It's not an easy answer. I think really ocean lifeguards often do work alongside, like you said, the fire department
EMS.
or other EMS, right? So they do work alongside that. When there is a rescue, oftentimes they rely also on the Coast Guard and other levels of response that in a pool environment, it's typically the lifeguard team that responds to the incident. I mean, obviously in a pool, it's a lot more controlled. And so ocean lifeguards, they have to battle a lot when they're, watching the water. And
The first step.
I think the legislation is a first step. These lifeguards, they need to have access. They should have access to some of the resources that EMT teams get. So there should be access to psychology
Training,
when it comes
advanced
to
training.
advanced training, PTSD also. It's all encompassing. So I think in
Exactly.
Florida, we're hoping we're going to be going in the right direction.
Good.
With legislation, yep.
So you've been traveling all over the world. You're an entrepreneur. You've been a lifeguard. You've been head, you're head of Swim Global Project. You've started it and founder and CEO. What have you learned that you can tell Hawaii about drowning prevention, and what one message would you like to tell our listeners?
What I can tell Hawaii is don't leave the action plan as a document that literally sits on a shelf. Refer back to it, change and update it often. Make sure that you have a direct link to the operational side of water safety and drowning prevention advocates, which means make sure you're connected to the YMCAs, maybe the Boys and Girls Clubs. Obviously, the beach lifeguards and those teams, because those are the frontline people who are going to be able to deliver, what an action plan is hoping to accomplish. Now, think about connecting with schools. Think about your population and what your population needs. Obviously, children are a priority, adults are a priority, children with autism, actually, older adults, we're seeing sort of a trend, an upward trend of them drowning as well. So, yeah, my recommendation is that this is an action plan. You need to do something with it, and you need to be able to find what metrics you're going to use to evaluate the success of the action plan. That would be kind of like my first guiding answer is use the action plan. Go back to it often. If a local region needs a specific action plan that is a little different because of geographical needs or just structures different, find ways to get that done.
Good point, Natalie.
You're
Thank you for
welcome.
joining us and bringing a global perspective to a challenge that is very local for us here in Hawaii. Hawaii is surrounded by
Absolutely.
water. That makes water safety more than a program or a lesson. It's a life skill and a shared responsibility. The challenge now is turning what we know into what we do, as you just said. Thank you again, Natalie. It was great to have you on the show.
Oh my
Congratulations
gosh.
on all your work you're doing and keep it up.
Aw, thank you so much. Really appreciated our conversation and yeah, look forward to chatting soon.